This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, which means we have a chance to check in with reporters in Northwest Indiana Media to find out more about the stories that they've offered up for everyone to listen to and to check out as well in print as well as online. And let's start things off here with one of our reporters from the Post-Tribune. Meredith Colius-Pete is with us. Meredith, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. A couple stories you had of an interest here involving education. First one, just came out here, involves a new contract for the superintendent of the Munster School District. Tell us about that.
Sure. You know, these kind of things are just standard procedure for school districts. Munster recently, the school board just recently voted to renew Superintendent Jeff Hendricks' contract for about 3 years now. So it is expected to extend through either 2020 or 2021. What was really of interest in that particular board meeting, though, was that, you know, a few years ago, Munster had kind of announced that it was looking at a pretty serious budget deficit, you know, about $8 million or so. Past couple of years, they've been working to close that, and it looks like they're projecting that that budget deficit will now be eliminated probably sometime by June.
Wow, I know that that Jeff Hendricks has been working very hard here in a number of areas to try to reduce that deficit. One of which is just making some changes in spending within the school district itself, and in turn at the same time trying to make sure that the buildings in the school district are up to snuff. And also lately too, part of that has to do as well with some efforts that have been made in some successful referenda that the Munster School District has been able to get from its voters and patrons, for that matter.
Right, and Munster is in a good position, you know, one of the better positions to deal with it, you know, deal with issues like this. They passed two budget referendums in recent years, one in 2013 and one just last year, that sort of helped them shore up their finances. And, you know, the biggest part of any school budget, when any public school district that you look at, is undoubtedly salaries. And a couple of years ago, they sort of, you know, moved to eliminate some, you know, positions and not raise all some others. And so they've said as well that's had an impact on their ability to close that gap.
Yeah. And I know, too, that although this is not Dr. Hendricks' fault and nothing, he's kind of suffering the results of that. The school districts had issues with former administrators, and it's ended up as being some matters that have ended up in court, and which in turn have meant money that had to have been taken out of that budget to pay off these people. Tell us the situation there and where things stand on that.
Sure, absolutely. And this has been, you know, a news story of big interest in this area. Munster certainly has, you know, long been considered one of the region's, you know, prestigious school districts. Their academics, you know, have remained, you know, in a very good position. About, you know, a few years back, two former administrators, you know, it appears that had been receiving payments. It's mostly in retirement or annuity payments, but they had been receiving payments over a period of about 15 years that were well above what had been agreed to in their contract. It sort of had started small in, you know, around 1999 or so, and had really snowballed over time. The state sued them last May or so in civil court. The total between these two men was about $850,000. That was William Misker and then Richard Sopko. The state was saying basically that they had arranged to, you know, receive these improperly, kind of receive these payments. It caused, you know, as you would imagine, it caused, you know, a lot of anger, particularly in Munster. You know, because this is a community, if you go out there and you ask voters for, you know, to raise property taxes to pay for schools, that, you know, that's going to be a pretty strong argument in this community, you know, to make sure that property values stay up and the school system stays, you know, kind of stays at the level that they want it to. Mm-hmm. But what the state was saying is that, you know, these men had improperly collected this money, and they were asking to repay. Now, what has happened in the court case very recently, Lake County Circuit Judge Marissa McDermott, who's sort of overseeing the civil case, threw a good chunk of this case out, almost all of it. And if this makes sense, then just stop me if it doesn't. You know, there was a question in this case because, you know, it had been about 15 years where these men had been collecting, you know, the salaries and, this money. And, you know, the school board was there. The school board is elected and is there to, you know, sort of oversee the district and oversee the spending and kind of what goes on. And, there's been sort of a lot of talk that perhaps that oversight job, which they're there to do, wasn't being done properly. You know, also the state comes in every 2 years, which is standard procedure to audit the books of every school district in the state. And, you know, somehow this was being missed on audits. What had happened about, a few years back, you had had some new school board members come on the board who had noticed this and reported it immediately to authorities. And the State Board of Accounts came in and they did an audit and they confirmed it. And so that's the genesis of where we are now. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned just a moment ago, the judge in this case has thrown out most of the case, because what it really comes down to are two issues. One is that the case law is saying that there's a 5-year statute of limitations in this case that the state can sue to reclaim money, basically. You have the attorney for these two men who are saying, well, their argument basically is that, you know, these men were doing nothing to hide this. This is all in the open, that this is all on, you know, account statements that the school board was signing off on a very regular basis. And so they're basically saying if, you know, it wasn't known to the school board at that point, then that's something that, you know, that was a failure of their job, that these men were doing nothing to hide this. And then you're having the state come in on the other side that's saying, well, this money was paid out improperly and that, you know, there needs to be some recourse to recover this money. So that's where we're at. McDermott set the statute of limitations back to about 2012. The vast majority of payments were made before that time. And so you have at this point the Attorney General's office is making sense to appeal that ruling.
We're talking with Meredith Colius-Pete with the Post-Tribune about some education stories that she's covered and offered us up in print and online here. And you had a chance recently, too, I understand, Meredith, to talk with Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick about some interesting issues. And tell us a little bit about your story and some of the things you brought up, which included some local issues as well, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I had the chance to sort of catch up with Jennifer McCormick, and she was up here in Lowell very recently. We got the chance to talk to her about quite a few different issues. One issue that's making national news certainly is that you're seeing a lot of teacher strikes. In Kentucky, West Virginia, Oklahoma, there's been some rumblings that Arizona might be next. The situation in Indiana is interesting because Indiana itself has seen sort of a 15% drop in average teacher pay since 2000, and that's the largest percentage drop that you've seen really in the whole country. Jennifer McCormick herself has noted this, and she sort of has seen, you know, is saying everywhere that she goes when she visits, various schools across the state that this issue comes up. The biggest issue that we're seeing is that there's a direct correlation to this issue and the state's ability to hire and retain teachers. She is saying that the issue is not the beginning salaries when the teacher first gets hired, but the problem is that there's really not sufficient raises over time, and that's been a big factor that you're seeing that's driving some of the teacher shortages that you're seeing in the state.
And I know, too, of course, she has to, on a larger scale than just the individual school district, she has to take a look at the picture as far as the legislature is concerned, because it's the legislature that determines the budget, and in turn, that is where money that operates school districts in across the state basically come from.
Right, and a lot of the teacher salaries and negotiations really happen at a local level. They really happen, you know, in negotiations between the local unions and administrators. McCormick, for her part, has said that, that she would support next session in Indianapolis is a budget session, so you're looking at that. And she said that she would support and lobby for, finding additional state money to help these local districts increase some of their pay for teachers.
I understand, too. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Pardon me. Go right ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I kind of asked her what level that she would be looking at. Of course, she said that this really depends on what the appetite for lawmakers for this sort of thing. She said that, 3% could be a compromise, but she would look at any increase in pay in her mind would be would be a positive development.
That'd be good to know, and hopefully that she'll be able to lobby the lawmakers and make the changes that she would like to make, too. One of the other things involving change was, of course, the issue involving the Gary Community School Corporation that you've written many stories on, and I'm sure you had a chance to talk with Superintendent McCormick about this. And in particular, I guess the latest issue is involving who gets to say what, who gets to run what.
Yeah, absolutely. Gary is a unique situation. Last session, Senate Bill 567, took away the power of the then superintendent and school board. And ever since then, you've seen some conflict in the Gary district, between the emergency manager and members of the elected school board. A lot of the issues there are really that from the elected school board's point of view, even though they have no power, they're sort of trying to see, what role did they play in the district. And so, I asked McCormick about this. She sort of thinks, she says she's seen both sides of this. On the other hand, Gary obviously has more than $100 million in long-term debt. Some of its schools are really struggling academically. And, she says that she's in favor of, having the emergency manager sort of in there, to have the ability to sort of unilaterally make these changes that would benefit students in the district. But at the same time, she does see that, the school board is there, it's elected, it's an institution, and that it has a role to play as well. So she's sort of playing it down the middle there. My colleague Carol Crossman certainly has covered this a lot more extensively than I have. But one thing that we are kind of looking at, the governor's expected to call a special session, in the middle of May or so. There was a bill this session, House Bill 1315. The main chunk of it would have authorized, Ball State University to take over Muncie schools, much in the way that Gary is under state takeover right now. However, there was, some provisions in that bill that. Eliminated a little bit more of the role of the Gary School Board. It's now limited to one meeting a month, there was an Attorney General opinion recently that basically gives it the power to, elect its own officers and refill vacancies and things of that nature. 1315 would have cut those meetings down to about four per year. It would have turned the elected school board into an advisory position. It certainly is, from a political standpoint, it is looking like that particular bill was sort of a vote of no confidence by lawmakers on the Gary School Board. Last month the session ended very abruptly. That bill was one that didn't get a vote. It's unclear whether or not that's going to come up. Now, the governor has said that only a small portion of that bill, which would have dealt with Muncie obtaining a state loan for its budget, that's really the part of the bill that he kind of cared about, and the rest of it kind of wasn't a priority for them. However, this week certainly the Gary School Board had a meeting where it had the ability to take a vote, probably the first time in about 8 months or so. It, of course, was very contentious. And, remaining to see whether or not, lawmakers are paying attention to that as well.
Finally, Meredith here, one of the things I know you had a chance to talk with Superintendent McCormick about is a topic that is very, very sensitive. Certainly, it's involving, at least as far as I understand in your story, that Dr. McCormick wants to carry it out even further than just public schools. That's the issue of safety in schools. Tell us what her ideas are about that, please.
Sure. Absolutely. After Valentine's Day, when you saw that very tragic, very horrible school shooting in Florida, the students there have been very vocal, that pleased in social media and TV appearances and things like that to really, push their campaign for gun control. You're seeing that's sort of had this wave across the whole country where people are very concerned about it. I know that people locally that we've talked to, administrators, parents, students down the line are all talking about school safety and their concerns. McCormick has been saying this for a bit that, public schools are required. They're required to come out with a safety plan, and what they would do. Charters, private schools taking voucher money don't have, officially don't have the same sort of requirements. And that's something that she would like to see is that, they have sort of the same plans in place.
Well, Meredith, that's a great story that you've had there talking with Dr. McCormick, as you have given us a little synopsis here, and we do appreciate that. And we hope that, that certainly we'll have a chance to get more. And you may have probably had a chance to talk with Dr. McCormick more than you could actually fit in the story there. So we may see another story come out about that sometime soon. Who knows? You never know. Meredith Kolias-Pete is a reporter, covers a lot of education-related stories for the Post Tribune, and she's been with us here to talk about these recent stories that she's had. Meredith, as always, thank you for being with us, and we'll hope to have back on again real soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
The debates and forums are all wrapped up. It's now time to find out who Northwest Indiana voted for on Tuesday, May 8th, with live coverage of primary election night here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Continuing on with the Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with John Gard. He covers a number of events and stories in LaPorte County for the LaPorte Herald Argus, as well as its companion paper, the Michigan City News Dispatch. And as always, John, thank you for being with us today on Regionally Speaking. We do appreciate the opportunity to check in with you here.
Hi, Chris.
Let's take a look here at the latest developments as the baby boxes are concerned, and one in particular that is within your coverage area. There. Tell us about the latest involving the box that's set up outside a volunteer fire station there in LaPorte County.
Yeah, this is really something, because when the first baby was left in the box in November, it was the first time in the nation that it occurred, because there are only two of this kind of box anywhere. One is in Cool Spring Township near Michigan City, and the other is in Woodburn. But the baby that was left last fall was the first in the nation, and this one, just 5 months later, came really close on the heels of the first.
Now, I know if you had pictures in the newspapers too, as to what this baby box looks like. It's gotten a lot of media coverage. It's probably the box itself has probably gotten more media coverage than the babies. Certainly, they've been found in it here. And you mentioned the one there at the township Cool Spring Township Volunteer Fire Department has the box that we're talking about here. And there's another one as well over across the state, over in Woodburn. These are, I guess, identical boxes, I understand.
Yes, they're provided by a not-for-profit organization called Safe Haven Baby Boxes. And the idea is that a mother who may be distraught for one reason or another, or who does not want to give birth to the baby in a hospital or whatever her circumstance might be, rather than disposing of the baby, which does happen, and we see in news reports now and then, she can bring her baby to a box, to one of these boxes, with anonymity. And it's sort of an extension of the state's safe haven law, which allows mothers to do that. As long as the babies are in good condition, they're allowed to bring babies to first responders, and these baby boxes are an extension of that idea.
I understand one of the volunteer firefighters, Lieutenant Chuck Kohler, was the latest person to find out about this baby here. From what you learned, how did he get word that there was another baby back in the box?
Yeah, the boxes are equipped with automatic alarms, mm-hmm. In this case, three alarms. One is when the box is opened, it sends an alarm to first responders. Second is when the baby is placed into the box, and then there's a button that the mother can push as a third option. So that sends an alarm to first responders, and in this case, volunteer firefighters. The station here is not manned, and so that's different than these kinds of baby boxes were grandfathered into the law that allowed these two boxes. But anywhere in the state now, hospitals and police stations and fire stations that are manned can use the baby boxes, but these are the only two that are at unmanned stations.
Now, I understand that the volunteer firefighters, in addition to Lieutenant Kohler getting the first word about the box being activated, the other volunteer firefighters were Johnny on the spot, I guess, and taking care of the baby, and we understand the child is doing all right now.
Yes, Lieutenant Kohler said he responded within a minute. He was,
wow.
He lives nearby, and he was on his way to the grocery store anyway, and he responded in less than a minute. And of course, as with the previous baby, the firefighters were very excited about being able to save a life, and as they say, that's why they're they do what they do is because the idea is to save lives, well, you know, without passing judgment.
And I understand, too, your story also mentions some response and reaction from the folks that created the idea for the boxes themselves, the Safe Haven baby boxes. What seem to be their thoughts about seeing these baby boxes being used here, especially this one twice now?
Right. Monica Kelsey, who is the founder of the foundation, the Safe Haven Foundation, was at the press conference this week. She was excited about it too, and she says that this just shows that the baby boxes work. Mm-hmm. And her foundation also provides assistance to pregnant women who may need help with direction and provide a full range of services. She's hoping that her efforts to extend this idea elsewhere will decrease the number of infant deaths that are reported annually in every state.
Now, I understand, too, that even though there are those who are opposed to the idea of having a baby left in an unmanned box someplace, it seems like with the quick response that we've had now in both cases there outside Michigan City have kind of cut back, I guess, on some of the opposition, I would imagine.
Well, that's the issue. And of course, this was the contention downstate when they were considering these laws. The opponents said that it might not be safe for the baby and that it might be inhumane to leave a baby in a box at an unmanned station. But advocates are saying, well, this is proof, especially with the second baby in 5 months, that this is proof that the boxes save lives.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with John Gard, who is with the LaPorte Herald Argus and also writes for the Michigan City News Dispatch about his stories of the week. I understand that they had an opportunity to catch up with one of the U.S. senatorial candidates here recently there in LaPorte County. Tell us what Todd Young had to say.
Yeah, and actually Todd Young is not running in this election, but he was here to rally support for other Republicans in the county. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of races, as you know, that are going on this year, and so he was there as sort of the standard bearer for the party, and he rallied the troops.
What else did he have to say to the other Republicans who were there about the state of the race, so to speak, races this week, this election coming up, I should say.
Yeah, well, his main message was he touted 2016 as if that was the year of promises, and of course referencing the presidential election and, right, and other offices. He said that if the year of 2016 was the year of promises made, that 2017 was the year of promises kept. And of course he had a whole litany of things, including the appointment of a Supreme Court justice for conservatives, and any number of other issues that he said that Republicans have got to rally around that message and make sure that other people know that that's the party to vote for.
Now, John, I understand one of the other stories that you had as well, too, in the newspapers involving governmental agencies, in particular law enforcement, was a report that came out, I guess, it's to the number of calls that police agencies in LaPorte County seem to get. And I guess it shows the need that maybe they need to have more people on the streets to deal with the crime and other issues.
Yeah, it was an annual report from the Sheriff's Department, and it showed that the trend towards increasing reliance on the Sheriff's Department for calls continued on the rise last year. The Sheriff John Boyd indicated that the number of calls had increased 17% from 2016 to 2017. And of course, he wanted to call attention to that because he knows that his deputies are so busy every day on any number of calls and types of responses.
Is he going to try to push the county council to try to be able to put more money in his budget so that he can hire more deputies?
Well, as he said, he's always advocated for additional officers. He's not going to ask for the number that might be required as along the lines of a recommendation from the Justice Department that suggests that there ought to be more officers than there are based on the population served. But he said he would like to see additional officers over time added to the staff.
He's trying to, I guess, make the balance between what he'd like to have, a number of officers on the street, and knowing that the LaPorte County Council has a certain finite amount of money they can work with and what they raise from property taxes every year. So they can't go over the limit. They have to kind of stick to the budget.
Right, right, and he's certainly making the case here that that there's a demand for that, and that it's it should be a priority for the county.
And I guess that the county council is going to do their best, I guess, to work with the sheriff on this.
Right, right, and the county council has just recently gave its support to a 65th officer mm-hmm. for that would handle measuring truck traffic, weight of trucks, and things like that on highways, oh. county highways. Mm-hmm. But the sheriff says there's still a good 15 officers short of the recommendation.
So another story that's going to happen again more in the future, I would imagine, too.
Sure.
We're talking with John Gard. He's a reporter for the LaPorte Herald Argus, as well as the Michigan City News Dispatch, about the stories he's had in the newspapers recently. And as always, John, thanks for being with us, and we'll hope you're happy to have back on again soon.
All right. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And on this Thursday, of course, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, where we have a chance to chat with Northwest Indiana media members to talk about the stories that they've offered up. And once again, we have a chance to get some good business news to you and some great highlights of some things that have changed in Northwest Indiana on the business scene. We turn to Joseph Pete, who covers business stories for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Joseph, thanks once again for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, a couple of things here, and I'll get you to talk in more detail about the continuing saga of, I guess, what you've referred to as retail apocalypse here in Northwest Indiana. But the latest addition to this is, I guess, some good news for people who like to shop at Carson's. And I know there's been concern around the country because of the Carson's parent company, Bon-Ton Stores, over in the East Coast, is seeking bankruptcy. And they're trying to dig their way out of that. But what's the latest development here that maybe there's somebody that might be interested in taking the company over?
Yes. Well, Bon-Ton, which owns Carson, has been they filed bankruptcy in February, and they've been really struggling. But there has been a group that, like last week, they sent a notice to the Indiana Department of Workforce Development saying that, you know, they're going to close the Carson's department store that they opened at South Lake Mall in Hobart back in 1975, lay off like 137 workers. But then now a group has come through that's attempting to save it, an investor group in the bankruptcy case. It's a bunch of different, it's a partnership of several different, like, retail investment trusts, and they've kind of rallied together in an attempt to save the chain, which is much bigger. It's like 200, but it's Bon-Ton Companies is 260 stores across the nation. It's also like the Bon-Ton, Boston, many different like regional brands of department stores. Carson's, the former Carson Perry Scott is obviously the one that we, you know and love here. But it's not a guaranteed deal. Unfortunately, there is a lot of pushback from creditors in the bankruptcy case. They have been. There are a group of creditors that are interested in acquiring, forcing liquidation, basically. So this investment group is currently kind of jostling in a bankruptcy court with the creditors to see if they can keep it going as like a going concern, or there's still the very real possibility it might fall into the hands of the creditors and they just liquidate everything, including the three stores in Northwest Indiana, the former Woodmar Mall site in Hammond, the Hobart location at South Lake Mall and the Michigan City location at the Marquette Mall. But hopefully, they'll be able to prevail in bankruptcy court and keep it going, because it would be a pretty significant setback. Like, it's been one of the main anchors for the South Lake Mall for decades. It's a large area employer. It's one of the biggest in the city of Hammond. It's one of the biggest shopping places left. And it's, it's a brand that people kind of grew up with and are familiar with, and people are just used to shopping there.
And we know for sure the one in Hammond certainly would draw a lot more business in the future if it stayed open as well, because with what the city of Hammond is doing with the sportsplex that is being built actually on the same property as the store there in Woodmar. And obviously, I think the city is hoping as well, too, that if they draw people in for the events that will happen there at the sportsplex, they'll want to be able to go next door and do some shopping, or family members certainly will if they're there. So another good reason to try and keep the Carson's operations stores open, and that one in particular, I would imagine. I know that that Montan stores have had problems even in recent years in some of the other operations they have. One in particular, they used to have an Eastern Indiana Elder Beerman store, and they had to close it up because it wasn't doing very well, unfortunately, for business, too. So a lot of people, I'm sure, will be definitely pleased to see that the name, at the least, and if not in intent, and certainly the spirit of Carson's will stay open if the company does get the manage work their way financially out of this problem. And you mentioned this is kind of a tie-in, I guess, in a way with other problems that have happened in Northwest Indiana with retailers that have had problems. So tell us where all this kind of fits in together.
Well, yeah, there's I didn't coin the term retail apocalypse. It's been kind of a national phenomenon we've been seeing, unfortunately, across the country. A lot of people are saying retail is like overbuilt in the good times. Developers are too easy, you know, too quick to put up, you know, strip malls and big box stores and so forth, and there's just too much retail space. But the main issue has been people are growing more and more accustomed to doing online shopping. They're more likely just to click and order a book or, you know, whatever off of Amazon rather than spend time at stores like looking for the right thing. And it's not that stores are not necessarily still profitable. It's just that it's eaten into the margins that they've, you know, historically been used to. A lot of these larger national retailers, they have huge operating expenses and they've racked up a lot of debt. In some cases, they're owned by, you know, these private equity funds that have just like loaded them up with debt from other things. And like Toys R Us was, you know, under different circumstances, it might have still been viable, but it was just the perfect storm that ended up, like, you know, doing it in and forcing it to liquidate everything. Carson's has been trying to right-size his footprint for years. About a decade, or less than a decade ago, they closed the River Oaks location at the in Cal City, and then they tried to open a clearance outlet just down the street in Lansing. That closed, like, maybe a year or two ago. They have... The city of Hammond owns their lease in the Woodmar location, and they gave them very favorable terms in the hope of keeping them there. They're trying to look for like a permanent, if the company does stay in business, to kind of a permanent fix to guarantee that they'll be there. They're thinking they're maybe too large. It currently is a two-story location with escalators and everything. It might be more suited to a more contemporary kind of, you know, big box store somewhere on or near the property.
Yeah.
And the mayor suggested that, you know, maybe perhaps they focus more on athletic goods specifically because of all the, because it's the Zet Sportsplex is expected to be a big youth sports hub they're going to bring in. It's not even so much for the local community as it's, though it can definitely be used by, but it's, the intent was to bring in all these, you know, the travel sports teams and make Hammond kind of a destination for that. They've been able to do some of that with all the baseball fields they've been putting in and everything. And they're looking at bringing in a lot of out-of-towners. If, you know, you're a parent and your kids are playing, you know, it's the closest store to go visit, you might pop in and, you know, buy something if you need, like, a necessity or, you know, whatever, to replace a cleats or something. But it would be a loss of another big box store. It would put the South Lake Mall in a difficult position because, unfortunately, right now there aren't a lot of big box stores that are growing nationally. Most are, you know, almost all the big ones, JCPenney's, Macy's, and so on, have been like Sears, definitely Sears, and Kmart have all been closing locations rather than opening them. And then when you're left with like a 200,000 square foot feet of space, it's very difficult to find one retailer to come in and fill that in this retail environment. Just too many people have migrated online. This doesn't mean the death of retail, but it's going to completely restructure how brick and mortar stores operate. You're probably not going to see as many of these hulking cavernous stores going forward. There's going to be a focus more on, you know, smaller stores and kind of like in-store experiences that you can't match with online shopping. But it's, you know, this would be just more, we've lost so many big box stores over recent years, like Gander Mountain, MC Sports, Sports Authority, all these companies that have been there for decades just suddenly went out of business. And The trend seems to have been stabilizing, but this is another case where it potentially could have a big impact locally.
Well, Joseph, I know one of the other stories that you offered up as well, too, and we've had a chance to check, I guess, updates as well now. It was about the big announcement that people who maybe they don't miss the pollution, but they might miss the operation of a power plant right on Lake Michigan, especially if they're driving on the Chicago Skyway or the toll road coming into Indiana. But the state line power plant site, the property itself is liable to be transformed into something very different. Tell us the latest on that, as you've heard from the dockages and other people involved in that.
Yes, this is a massive project. They're looking at putting in what they're calling the Indiana NAP data center. It would potentially be one of the largest data centers in the Midwest. They're looking at investing at least like $40 million right away to build like a 100 square foot data center building, but they're looking initially for the first phase about 400,000 square feet, and if it does, it would be kind of multi tenant. Basically, a data center is where they house tons and tons of servers, because we use so much data these days, whether we're on our phones or streaming through Netflix or just any of these online uses. All these smart cars now are just going to be generating more and more data, and it all has to be stored somewhere. When you're watching, Frozen 2 at home or whatever, it has to. That has to come from somewhere. What they do is they build these giant warehouses full of computer servers where they store the data, and they're looking at putting a massive one in at the former State Line Generating Plant. It's right on the border of Chicago and Hammond. It juts out into Lake Michigan. It had previously been one of the worst polluters in Chicagoland. They had multiple Clean Air Act violations, which is what ended up ultimately shutting it down. Dominion Energy had purchased it, but they were determined that it would be too cost prohibitive to kind of come in and clean it up to the extent. It had been a beautiful Art Deco building that dated back to the 1930s with some very impressive brick masonry and so forth. Yeah. So some people lamented the loss of the building, but it was it was pumping a lot of emissions into the atmosphere. And what they're currently talking about doing with this data center project, which could be, $200 million investment, 100 permanent jobs, 250 construction jobs, it would involve wind power and solar power to help provide energy, because data centers use tons and tons of energy to keep the computers going. I believe it was the Mr. Dockich, the attorney for the developer, who was making the point that if you leave a laptop on your lap for like 5 minutes, you already start to feel it burn. And imagine that when you have thousands and thousands of computers in the same place. Yeah. And that's partly why they want to put it on the lake, too, because the lake breeze and the water from the lake would be used to help kind of cool off the operations there. And this would be much cleaner than a lot of the industrial uses. They have the steel mill and the oil steel mills and the oil refineries kind of do the same thing where they're on the lake, where they use the water for cooling purposes. However, in those cases, they're often releasing chemicals and toxins back into the lake, that whether it's you had that hexavalent chromium spill and so forth, but then they're actually permitted to release small amounts of those materials into the lake. But in this case, the water would strictly be used for cooling. All that they would basically be releasing back into Lake Michigan would be warmer water. And it's part of the reason why the project is being so heralded is because it would kind of help transform the image of Northwest Indiana. It's certainly more modern than a lot of the other, it's not as big an employer, but it's a more modern kind of tech use. And it could be billed as a way to lure other tech companies, because the site is sitting on some dark fiber that it would allow for very fast internet usage. And then you can make the point to, any prospective tech companies eyeing anywhere in the area that there's this, they'd have like almost unlimited offsite data storage at the site. And that's a huge asset that they hope would potentially help, diversify and modernize the economy and maybe help bring in some more tech firms.
Now, from what you understand from the initial announcement here from Tom Dockich and the people involved in this project, what kind of timetable are they looking at here? That hopefully, if they get all the approvals that they need to have made and get all the land lined up, and it's pretty much the site itself, but there's a lot of work I know that has to be done ahead of time. When do they hope to be able to start building something or have something open?
Yes, they're actually looking at a fairly aggressive timeline. The site had already been kind of demolished and cleaned up. The previous owners, It's a developer. It's the same principals that own the Beemster Bohr Slag Company.
Yeah.
And they had been looking at coming in and putting in like a marina and like for like bigger boats. It would be right near the Hammond Marina or Marina, I'm sorry. And, you know, lakefront condos and that kind of thing. But the site is very difficult to develop because it's like right by a ton of train tracks that separate it. It's kind of isolated. There's high tension power lines ahead. Commonwealth Edison in Illinois still has multiple transformers on the site. It's just like remote, heavily industrial, isolated. It's hard to reach. It's they ultimately weren't able to go forward with their original plans for making it more residential. So, but they had cleaned the site and cleaned the property, and now the data center developers are looking at coming in and starting like fairly soon. They were hoping to get like city approval within the next couple of weeks, mm-hmm. and that they were looking at starting the first phase this summer. But it's like a multi-phase project that they're looking at. They're going to do the first phase, and then kind of gauge and see how much demand there is. That they expect the demand because they're going to lease to a number of different places, like content providers like Netflix or Hulu, like large banks, large pharmacy chains, telecommunications companies. There's a variety of institutions, that need this kind of data storage, and that they are, if that's successful, they would continue to build it out over the next several years. But they're basically looking at putting modular buildings on the site, so it would be kind of installed like one at a time, and then they would add, they would continue to add capacity as necessary.
We're talking with Joe Pete, who's the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about stories that he's offered up online as well as in print here. And I know that, Joe, one of the recent stories you've had here stays along with the idea of the technology changes that we're all going through these days. Tell us about how a Crown Point firm is taking advantage of the Internet and of new technology to help promote local bands of all people and groups.
Yes. Yes, there is a. They've developed an app that's not. It'll be available for download soon on Android and for the iPhone. It's called ShakeRate, and their concept is that it's been difficult, like since the collapse of the traditional record agencies, it's kind of been difficult for local bands to be able to kind of tour nationally and build up more of a national audience. Previously, a lot of the record labels have been doing a lot of the promotions to that. They note that a lot of the acts filling like the larger venues, like Wrigley Field and so forth, are kind of like dated acts like Fall Out Boy or Eddie Vedder that were maybe at the height of their popularity, a while ago at this point. And they are hoping that they... people will download this app, use the iPhone, and then they would basically kind of shake it to signify their approval of the band. And if they aren't, that physically demonstrative, they would just kind of swipe like it's one of the dating apps, and that local bands would be able to get like really high scores on these things and then be able to show that off to promoters in other cities. Like bands from Chicago might be able to go on the road better to Minneapolis or Cincinnati, or find somebody to book a gig for them there so that they can not just be confined to the local market. They're looking at doing free concerts to kind of test this out and kind of get it ramped up and off the ground. They're planning one with the band, the Chicago band South City Revival, at 8 p.m. on April 27th at the Super Bowl in Crown Point. And it's a free concert. They're just encouraging people to come in, download the app, and then use it to promote the band.
Well, it sounds like the promoters and the developers of this particular app are really got some innovative ideas going here, and it may be a little early in the process, but are they looking to any type of expansion?
They're saying if they get a lot of attendance at the first concert, they're going to try and bring in acts more regularly. The first band that they've signed on is this kind of alternative country band, South City Revival. And I didn't go too in-depth with them on their rollout plans. They would need to get – it's a free app. It does have some other features besides the band ratings that might be of use to concert goers, particularly. Well, it uploads like photos and video to your social media, but the one thing people might be really interested in is if you go to a concert, it lets you share your photos and video with other people who attended the concert. So like if you're far away from the stage and you weren't able to get good shots, you'd be able to see like what photos other people were able to you know, take and that kind of thing. And, you know, some people might search for that on Instagram or Twitter while they're, but this would be a more direct, easier way to find, you know, what other people were posting about, you know, a particular concert.
I just had also, too, to kind of wrap things up, Joe, that they had one story here that I actually got to see in a national sense and didn't realize at first it was a local story. And we're talking about a Valparaiso teenager who just happens to enjoy donuts. All she did, or cupcakes, rather, and all she did was go to a store to get more cupcakes, and she got fat-shamed, and she's able to turn that around and work that to her advantage, and she's gotten a lot of response to the positive about it, I understand.
Yes, somehow the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom ended up breaking the story. Not quite sure how that happened, but it is what it is. There was, right before Easter in the Designer Desserts, which is a very popular cupcake bakery in Valparaiso. They also have a Cherryville location. They were running a sale to get rid of their inventory. They're going to be closed for Easter. Yeah. They were trying to, you know, they want to keep it fresh, and they were trying to get rid of everything. A 19-year-old barista from a nearby Starbucks went there just to buy a couple, I think to buy like half a dozen cupcakes initially, and then there was a long wait in line. There was a lady ahead of her who was having some problems cashing out, and then the woman behind her was getting quite frustrated and made an incredibly like rude remark about, thank God, let's hope this fat expletive doesn't buy all the cupcakes. And she was taken aback by this, so she ended up buying all the cupcakes. There weren't that many left, so she ended up spending $54 to kind of clear out the case, to, you know, stand up to this woman. And her story really resonated with people. It really took off on social media. I haven't checked today, but earlier this week, it was shared more than like 27,000 times, liked more than 87,000 times. People were applauding her for kind of like, you know, courageously taking a stand and not putting up with, you know, this woman's rudeness. And then, it's really taken off all over the world. It's been in Cosmopolitan Magazine, New Zealand Herald, the Daily Mail, multiple outlets in England for whatever reason, and television newscasts all across the country. She's done a lot of press. She, has been interviewed by like Australian radio stations. It's just people found this story very relatable. And,
it just seems to me that this woman who was very upset about having to wait in line so long just to get some cupcakes, making a rude remark, and this certainly shows that you have to be careful about what you say, because what you have to say does have consequence. And in this case, this person in particular probably doesn't even know about it now. And she's probably been, I'm sure, shamed in her own right for having said that to begin with now.
Oh, I'm sure. It's almost inescapable, the story at this point. It's gotten so big. I'm sure this will cause her to kind of reflect on her actions and maybe be nicer to people. But Designer Desserts has been getting calls, too, from like all over the world, from Canada, from Australia, from England. And people are wanting to support them or support the young woman who was, you know, subjected to that. And they've been telling people, like, buy a $5 gift card. We'll drop it off to her, because they've already stance on social media saying they're very anti-bullying. They're not going to tolerate bullying in their establishment. Mm-hmm. They're just there to sell cupcakes. They don't care, you know, who you are, you know, whoever you are, they're just there to sell you cupcakes. They accept everybody no matter what. And people shouldn't be going in there and judging other people and that harshly and everything. And that they are, they've been very supportive of her. They've dropped off cupcakes for free for her and her colleagues at Starbucks a couple times since then. Her puppy is about to turn one, and they're looking at giving her what they call pupcakes, which are cupcakes they bake for dogs. That's a thing now they do. Starbucks will do the foam and the coffee cup for dogs too.
Wow.
But they're just trying to have her back, and they stressed, the owner put a very passionate message on Facebook saying they're not going to tolerate, you know, these disgusting types of attitudes and not going to let anybody, you know, go shame people in their establishment.
Joseph Pete covers business news here in Northwest Indiana for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Joe, thanks for being with us today, and talk to you real soon, I hope.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You're listening to Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Baker man is baking bread. like a man.
It's time to jump on the Let's Eat trolley as we visit Crown Point to check out our bread man, Craig, and his wife and co-worker, Nadine, from Beck's Crown Bakery. Craig just doesn't make bread. Craig and Nadine make all your favorite confectionery delights. This Friday, visit us and get answers to your baking questions from the professionals. Join the conversation for a chance to win a gift card from Beck's Crown Bakery or Chef Nick's Eatery out of Winfield. Call in 769-9577. Let's Eat with me, Chef Nick, and Sharon Jackson will be coming at you live this Friday at 3 o'clock on 89.1 FM, Lakeshore Public Radio.
Bacon man is making bread.
A local leader in school is supporting new ways to help teach STEM to students by coming up with a way to incorporate art into it. We find out more about that in this from Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson.
A Highland art teacher is one of the latest recipients of a grant from the Highland Education Foundation. She was awarded for her idea that is changing the way STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math is viewed. HEF president and founder Judy Caddick says the organization that she created in 2015 is there to support teachers who develop a new and innovative way to teach a concept.
We raise money to give grants to classroom teachers for creative and innovative ideas that they want to implement in their classroom.
Julie Bensinger, who has taught art in Highland schools for 14 years, is one of several recipients from HEF's first cycle of grants to enhance the learning environment. She identified the need for STEAM, which is incorporating art in STEM education, that's science, technology, engineering, and math, in her classroom. Caddick says by integrating art and design with STEM subjects, Bensinger was able to strengthen her students' abilities to be creative problem solvers.
She wrote a grant to purchase these kits. They're called Little Bits, and they're like electronic Legos, and kids can do amazing things with these. These Little Bits actually were recognized as the 2018 Toy of the Year.
The Little Bits are a platform of easy-to-use electronic building blocks that allows the user to invent creations from remote control structures to a smart home device. The creations one can achieve are unlimited, according to Bensinger. She says using their imagination, students can create an idea, prototype it, test it, receive feedback from their peers, revise it, and develop a working design. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. And this week, I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And our sincere thanks to Meredith Colius-Pete of the Post-Tribune, to John Gard of the Michigan City News-Dispatch and the LaPorte Herald-Argus, and Joseph Pete from the Times of Northwest Indiana for their stories, and as well from Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson, for her piece that you just heard. That's it for this week. Back with you on Monday.